This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Bill Hammack. Today, I'm looking at the lives of three great personalities from America's mid-century, Dwight Eisenhower, George Marshall, and Douglas MacArthur. And in a new book called 15 Stars, today's guest tells the story of their interconnected lives and opens a fascinating window on the crucial events of the 20th century. And I invite you to call with your questions at 333-WILL if you're in the area, or if you're anywhere else in North America, call me at 800-222-WILL. That's 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Also, keep in mind that you can listen to WILL live via the internet at www.will.uiuc.edu. Let's welcome to the Afternoon Magazine, Stanley Weintraub.
Glad to be with you.
Well, Stanley, you have a fascinating kind of triple biography here, and well, these are all well-known figures. What's interesting is how you interrelate them, and I want to start by looking at the relationship between and among the men. For example, were Marshall and Eisenhower close friends?
They were never close friends. In fact, Eisenhower always addressed Marshall as "Dear General" in his letters, and in person he was "General."
And can you tell us, did Marshall ever call Eisenhower Ike, or did he also address him in a formal way?
Marshall was a very unusual figure. He tried to play no favorites at all. He was very aloof, a man of great integrity. He didn't want to indicate that he had any partiality for anybody. And so Eisenhower was always called Eisenhower.
Mm-hmm. And what about MacArthur and Eisenhower? What was their relationship?
Their relationship was extremely difficult. There was only a 10-year span between them, but MacArthur was chief of staff of the Army at the time that Eisenhower was only a major. Mm-hmm. And Eisenhower was his secretary. Eisenhower wrote his speeches, his memos, and so on. And later on, when they became peers, when both were five-star generals at the end of World War II, the nastiness was quite strong. And Marshall was a five-star general made at the same time as the other two. MacArthur called Eisenhower the best secretary he ever had, mm-hmm. and was very pleased that he had about a two-day seniority in the naming of the general, so he was still senior to Eisenhower. Eisenhower responded by telling his intimates that he learned dramatics under MacArthur.
Mm-hmm. And he called MacArthur General Impossible. Does that represent the difficulties Eisenhower had working with MacArthur?
He had difficulties working with MacArthur in the Philippines. MacArthur had gotten used to being serviced in all kinds of clerical ways by Eisenhower and invited him to go to the Philippines with him when he retired from the Army and was looking for another post. Eisenhower decided he'd go because it looked like a good opportunity, but it turned out that he was only being exploited. And yet he spent 7 years altogether under MacArthur. Finally, he was fed up with MacArthur's posturing, MacArthur's lying. And besides, he knew that with war coming, if he wanted to make anything of himself, make a career, he had to get out from under the domination of MacArthur, who liked toadies. He didn't like people to answer him back.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe it would help that if we took the three men at their most famous moment, which is perhaps World War II, and put them in the proper pecking order in terms of military hierarchy and relationships. What was the relationship among the three, you know, formally?
That was a fascinating pecking order. It's a good term to use. MacArthur was in the Philippines when Pearl Harbor occurred, 9,000 miles away from Washington. General Eisenhower was then a new general. He was a one-star general, just made a brigadier general under Marshall, who admired his work in the pre-war maneuvers in Louisiana. And suddenly Marshall, who was a peer and equal to MacArthur, both had been now chiefs of staff, Marshall needed somebody very desperately to work for him in Washington because a colonel who had been one of his deputies had been sent to Pearl Harbor to look at the damage. And on the way there, his plane crashed in the High Sierras. And when Colonel Bundy died, Marshall looked in his little black book where he kept names of people he thought ought to be movers in the Army, and found Eisenhower and arranged that Eisenhower should come from San Antonio, where he was with an Army in training, to Washington. And with all the work that Marshall had to do, after all, he had a world war suddenly on his hands, and he had to look out over everything. He wanted Eisenhower in particular because Eisenhower had served in the Philippines and knew that background. And so the cables and letters and orders that came from General Marshall to General MacArthur, written as Marshall, were actually written by Eisenhower. And so Eisenhower, the former secretary to MacArthur, suddenly became, unknown to MacArthur, his boss.
Mm-hmm. So Marshall was the chief of staff, is that right? The very top of the pecking order.
Yeah, Marshall was at the top of the pecking order, but MacArthur had tried to keep him down for many years.
Mm-hmm.
He prevented his promotions. He was very difficult to get along with. He wanted to be the top banana and remain that way. But finally, when he had to retire and looked for something else to do, went to the Philippines, there was somebody just worming a seat in Washington as chief of staff, and warming a seat quite literally until Marshall could get there.
Mm-hmm.
And Marshall suddenly raised, finally, from colonel to brigadier general. On the day the war began in Europe, September the 1st, 1939, he became chief of staff and went from one star to four stars.
Mm-hmm.
In one day.
Hmm.
And so he was suddenly not only the equal of MacArthur, but MacArthur had to give up his four stars when he left being chief of staff. He was very bitter about that.
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly Marshall was his superior.
Now, in your book, you show covers of Time magazine from the 40s and 50s, and at one time, each of these men was featured alone on the cover. Two of them were Men of the Year. Can you give me a sense of how popular or prominent each man was as a celebrity, if you will? What was their profile in the nation?
The profile of MacArthur as celebrity began very early, began even before Time magazine was founded. Because he was a legitimate hero in World War I, won almost every medal there could be, and was made superintendent of West Point when the war ended, and so he kept his brigadier general star. On the other hand, when the armistice came in 1918, Marshall, who was also in France and a deputy to General Pershing, the commander, was reduced from colonel to his highest permanent rank because the Army was downsizing.
Mm-hmm.
So where one went up, the other went down, and Marshall went from colonel to captain. Well, MacArthur went from brigadier general to major general. So Marshall had a long way to go to catch up,
mm-hmm.
and it took him all through the 20s and the 30s. To catch up to MacArthur.
But by the 40s and 50s and so on, these were the people on the front of Time magazine. What did that mean? I mean, today we kind of glance at the magazine.
Well, it was at a time when being Man of the Year and on the cover of Time meant something. To be on the cover alone was a big deal, but to be Man of the Year was an even bigger deal.
Mm-hmm.
And strangely, MacArthur, who was on the cover several times, never was Man of the Year, never made that way, although many people thought he was, because in the last issue of 1941, when MacArthur was in the Philippines as the only general involved in a fighting war, he was on the cover and titled MacArthur of the Philippines. But that wasn't the Man of the Year cover. The next week, the Man of the Year was President Franklin
mm-hmm.
Roosevelt. People wondered, I think, for many years after the war, and in fact after MacArthur's death, why he had never been made Man of the Year. he was both admired and disliked by Henry Luce, the publisher,
mm-hmm.
who really didn't trust him.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, Henry Luce's wife, Claire Booth Luce, was a great admirer of MacArthur, and so there must have been some household arguments over the years over MacArthur's standing. But MacArthur always believed what he had just said at the moment, even if he invented it.
Mm-hmm.
And this was something that Luce couldn't stand.
Now, you noted that each of them was a five-star general eventually. Were they the first five-star generals, and how did that honor come about? Did we have five-star generals before World War II?
We had never had five-star generals. We had one super general rank after World War I, and that was General Pershing. And that was a sort of standalone thing. And he was named General of the Armies with his stars. But then that rank went into oblivion. The problem is that when the Army increased in size tremendously, once Pearl Harbor came along, it wasn't enough to have three-star generals and four-star generals. The three-star general rank, Lieutenant General, was the highest that Ulysses Grant ever got in the Civil War. It took a long time before they even arranged to have a lieutenant general at that time. After World War II began, we discovered that the British had a five-star rank with admirals and generals, and the generals were called field marshal. The Russians had not only five-star rank, but given their huge numbers in the army, they invented a marshal of the Soviet Union six-star rank. And there was pressure in Congress to try to get even with them in some way because these other allies of ours outranked our generals. But Marshall didn't like the idea of being called Marshall. And he didn't see any reason anyway for the distinction of five stars.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, Congress insisted on it, and to satisfy Marshall, instead of our having field marshals at five stars, they named them General of the Army and Admiral of the Fleet. So Admiral Nimitz, for example, became Admiral of the Fleet.
Mm-hmm.
This was never used. They were just general.
Mm-hmm.
But there were only something like seven of them at the end of World War II, admirals and generals.
Mm-hmm. Stanley, I want to take a caller. We have a caller on a cell phone from Kankakee, so caller on line four. Please go ahead.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Very interesting program. Just a couple of quick questions, and I'll go ahead and ring off and listen off the air.
Mm-hmm.
With regards to MacArthur, I had an uncle long since passed, but he termed him Dugout Doug from World War I, whereas MacArthur got all these medals, but when it came to actually his military prowess, that was something in question, and I don't know if there's any volition to that.
Mm-hmm.
Also, too, I was wondering if the guest could speak to the relationship Eisenhower had with MacArthur at the time of the Bonus Army, the tents in Washington, and the job that MacArthur had to do there. And finally, my last question is, I'm pretty sure MacArthur died in 64. I think Eisenhower mm-hmm. died in 71. Was wondering how long Marshall lived and what year he died. And I'll go ahead and hang up. Thanks.
All right. Stanley, why don't we take those backwards?
Well, we have a number of questions there.
Right. I'll help you with them. Why don't we start with when Marshall died?
Marshall died, I think, in 1969. It was
59, wasn't it?
Than mm-hmm. MacArthur. MacArthur was an amazingly healthy man. He almost never saw a doctor until the very last years. He had a doctor on the staff, but the doctor wasn't allowed to do anything relating to him.
So our caller also wanted to know about the relationship between MacArthur and Eisenhower. Dugout Doug, he called them. Have you heard this?
The relationship between MacArthur and Eisenhower was entirely an obsequious one. There was nothing. Eisenhower was chewed out whenever he tried to answer back. Whatever he wrote for MacArthur was not ever credited to him. Everything was always done mm-hmm. under MacArthur's name. And even during the war, when there were events that occurred that should have given some kind of brownie points to particular officers or to units, MacArthur wouldn't allow it. They were always called MacArthur's men.
Mm-hmm.
He just wouldn't do it. It exasperated Eisenhower tremendously, and eventually he had to take off. He was involved with MacArthur in the Bonus Army situation. This was in 1932, in the last year of Herbert Hoover's presidency. Veterans of World War One had been promised a bonus because of their service. However, the bonus was only to take effect many, many years later because Calvin Coolidge, who was president during the time the bonus was arranged, wouldn't allow any money to be spent for it. During the Depression, the veterans were desperate, and they wanted some kind of government support. And a group of them marched on Washington and set up tents on the outskirts of Washington, calling themselves the Bonus Army, hoping to put pressure on Congress. But it was the Depression. Herbert Hoover was arch-conservative anyway. He didn't want to spend any money on anything, and he wouldn't hear of it. Finally, MacArthur convinced him that they ought to drive the bonus marchers out of Washington. And MacArthur, although he was chief of staff and a four-star general, went out with what amounted to a battalion of soldiers. He shouldn't bother to do it at all, but he wanted the glory of having removed these radicals from Washington. He said if we didn't remove them, we'd have a revolution. And, of course, that was quite unlikely. This was a pitiful group of veterans. He went out there. He helped drive them out of Washington, wearing all his medals and his full uniform, and he insisted that Eisenhower and Patton and others who worked for him also appear there in full uniform. It was a very embarrassing situation. They set the tents of the bonus marchers afire and forced them out. It was the newspapers called this the lowest point in MacArthur's career, and Roosevelt, who was then governor of New York, told one of his aides, "Well, I guess this elects me." And he was quite right. That was the end of Hoover. But he kept MacArthur on for an extra year because he wanted the continuity. But that was all. And then MacArthur had to find something else to do.
And our caller had his third question. Actually, the very first one he asked was whether the moniker Dugout Doug, which was impugning MacArthur's military prowess, whether that was well-deserved or correct or just completely off base.
The Dugout Doug was certainly well-deserved. It's interesting that when John Kennedy, as a young naval officer, wrote home to his parents. He said that he had heard the dugout Doug phrase, but he wasn't sure, you know, how it pertained to MacArthur. Well, he found out eventually. But what had happened is that although MacArthur claimed credit for anything his troops in the Philippines did, self-dialed himself hero of Bataan, the Bataan Peninsula, where our troops were finally trapped. He only visited the Bataan Peninsula once. He spent 2 hours at the tip of it at a headquarters unit, and he was never on Bataan again. And yet he called his aides his Bataan gang. He named his private plane the Bataan, and so on. He made a big thing of it, but he actually was never involved in any kind of activity near the front lines until the last months of the war, when suddenly he realized he was in the Philippines then, that he had to do something to look like the blood and guts figure that people thought he was. Soldiers at that point didn't expect to see him on the front lines, but he waded into the Philippines beaches from landing craft for the photographers. And you have to understand that when he did that, the photographers were already on the beach with their cameras poised at him. So it isn't that he was leading any troops onto the beaches. And he did that at Leyte Island, and he did it again at Luzon. These pictures became famous, but they were phony. Dugout Doug just didn't exist until even later than that. He went with Australian troops to Borneo, and at one point was actually in the line of fire, and the photographer next to him got hit. And that was about as close as he got to the war, and that was in the last month of the war.
Mm-hmm. This is Bill Hammack, and I'm speaking with Stanley Weintraub, and we're talking about 3 5-star generals, George Marshall, Dwight Eisenhower, and Douglas MacArthur. And I invite you to call with your questions at 333-WILL if you're in the area or anywhere else, 800-222-WILL.
I should mention, by the way, that Eisenhower was also aloof from the war. He was never really near the front. Mm-hmm. In France, in North Africa, in Italy. He kept aloof and let others go out and do his scouting for him. Even in the Battle of the Bulge, he wasn't close to the war. But once in the Philippines, I'm sorry, once in Italy, he actually fired his service pistol. He was staying overnight at a castle in Italy that had been arranged for his stay, and he went into his bathroom and discovered a rat sitting on the toilet seat. He took out his pistol and he shot at it. He missed twice, but he got the rat's tail on the third shot.
Stanley, I'd like to turn to another caller. We have a caller in Champaign County who has been very patient. So caller on line one, please go ahead.
Hi, yeah, and I do have to run, so I'll try and get this out. Mm-hmm. This is sort of the general dynamics story, and I'm wondering whether you have any insights about the current infighting going on between the generals about Iraq, but that is an aside. But it's a wonder that everybody, there's so many boulevards named after MacArthur. You mentioned several times lying and being duplicitous. I'm thinking of I.F. Stone's The Hidden History of the Korean War, which was written contemporaneously, and he shows that MacArthur would actually manipulate the battleground, like withdraw when it wasn't really warranted, just to sort of manipulate the Congress and the situation, which also makes me remember that MacArthur wanted to be president, and Eisenhower never really was thought to be, but Eisenhower ran on ending the Korean War, which was sort of seen as cleaning up MacArthur's mess. I don't know if you have any comments. I'll go and listen on the air.
Eisenhower actually ended the war on the terms that Harry Truman had set up, and Truman lost the presidency. In fact, he didn't run again. But there was no question that the war had to be ended. It was a quagmire, and the quagmire had been made by MacArthur. I was there, by the way. I was an army officer in Korea during the war.
Mm-hmm.
The stories about MacArthur, which were all negative, were all true. He flew in from Tokyo for photo op, literally, for photo opportunities. He would stay a few hours behind the lines, meet with generals, have his picture taken, have a press conference with local journalists, and then he'd fly back for dinner in Tokyo. The only time he did that, I would guess, 15 or 16 times during his stay in Korea, or rather during his period in the Korean War, which lasted about 10 months. And only once, when he landed at Incheon, was he actually in an area where there had been fighting. And he went to Seoul, which he insisted be taken for the anniversary of the invasion. And it was very costly, but it was done. And while he was at a big ceremony in Seoul, the shooting was still going on nearby. So we can say that he actually was involved in an area that was still hazardous at that point. But he never spent a night on the ground in Korea. He went back to the ship, the flagship that he was on in Incheon Harbor, to sleep and to have his meals. So even his few days there, he never spent a day on the ground, a night, rather, on the ground.
Well, your stories about MacArthur remind me that in your book, one of the central themes is that each of these men represents something bigger about America, almost a symbol. In fact, in your book, you spell out how each represents a geographic area or a socioeconomic level of the U.S. I mean, you say MacArthur was always city, Washington, Manila, Tokyo, and in later years, a New York high-rise apartment. What were the lives or images of Marshall and Eisenhower? What did they correspond to?
Marshall was the small-town boy. He grew up in a small town in southwestern Pennsylvania. He didn't go to West Point. He went to Virginia Military Institute. Everything in his case was sort of second class, though he turned out to be first class in the long run. Eisenhower was the farm boy. His family was quite legitimately a farm family in Kansas, although later in his life he became a big city person, president of Columbia briefly in New York, and then president at the White House in Washington. But he kept the farm image going. When he sold his memoirs, The Crusade in Europe, and made a bunch of money out of that, he used it to buy his farm at Gettysburg. And so he became the farm boy again in his later years. Mm-hmm. But it was a manicured, modeled farm with pedigreed cows and so on.
Kind of a gentleman farmer. Well, yes. you've mentioned Marshall, and I want to get back to him a little bit, because in this book, and we can see it with our callers, that MacArthur is simply the most colorful, the most controversial. And I want to take a look instead a little bit at the more somber Marshall and to a degree Eisenhower. So, and Marshall, you noted that MacArthur was a brilliant student at West Point. Surely this was also true for Marshall, who became the organizer of victory for the Allied powers in World War II. At VMI, was he a top student?
He was not the great student. Mm-hmm. At Virginia Military Institute, there is no record of him as being the top student in the class or anything like that. Mm-hmm. He doggedly made his way in the Army, and at every step, it turned out that he knew how to plan ahead. He knew what to do next. He was always at the top of the game, whether he was in the Philippines or in China in his early years, or in France, where he organized everything. He was the logistics man, moving hundreds of thousands of men around very quickly in France. So he literally was the organizer. He knew how to do that, but he was never flamboyant. Mm-hmm. The flamboyance was strictly that of MacArthur, the colorful one who wanted his medals and wanted his rank, and would wear a fancy scarf in battle with his troops rather than ordinary uniform, and wore a hat with his scrambled eggs, colorful gold braid on it that he invented for himself. This was a very different kind of man. We can't put Eisenhower in that picture because he never even got to France.
Mm-hmm. Now, Eisenhower was about a decade younger than these two.
Yeah, he was 10 years younger. Mm-hmm. It was a very different situation. The difference between the flamboyant Marshall, MacArthur, rather, and the very, what shall I call him, uptight Marshall may have been due to Marshall's marriage. That's a very interesting situation. Mm-hmm. Marshall married a girl who had been his older brother's girlfriend at first. Then she went for Marshall, and they married. Lily was a very beautiful woman. But on their wedding night, she told him that she had a heart condition, and sex would be out of the question, that it might kill her. And so there was never a consummated marriage. And he spent 20 years or so with Lily, had no children. The marriage was perhaps loving, although unconsummated. And I think that caused, in his physical deprivation, a kind of uptight quality that translated into a rigidity that became integrity on his part. But there was a rigidity about him, so that he made very few close friends. He called people, for the most part, by their surnames. There were very few otherwise. President Roosevelt's chief assistant, Harry Hopkins, was Harry, one of the very few like that. But there were very few. He married a second time when his wife died. Apparently, it was a legitimate complaint on her part. But he married a widow with three children, who was wonderful to him, and it was a very, very affectionate marriage. The children loved him, and they wondered what to call him, and they decided since at the time he married, he was a colonel. We'll call him Colonel. So he was never Dad or George or anything else like that. He was Colonel to the stepchildren.
And Stanley, I want to turn to another caller. We have a caller in Urbana. So caller on line one, please go ahead.
Yes. I wonder about MacArthur. For a long time, I believe his family refused to release many of his papers because they were afraid he would have an unfavorable biography. Have they released those, or am I not remembering things correctly?
I don't think that's that was a serious concern, because many of the papers that might have been derogatory were probably destroyed. There is a MacArthur Museum and Memorial in Norfolk, Virginia, that has a huge quantity of papers of his. And they've also collected not only his papers, but the papers of anybody who had anything to do with him, who wanted to give the papers to their memorial. They also have oral histories of people who worked under him. And I've used those papers, the papers are not necessarily admiring. So you can find a quite objective point of view of MacArthur in the MacArthur Museum.
Mm-hmm. I'm thinking back to the period shortly after his death, or perhaps even before, and I'm glad to hear that they are available. And
Many papers, of course, disappeared because he had to abandon everything in Manila in December 1941. When he and his group fled from Manila and as the Japanese invaded to Corregidor Island. And then they had to flee from Corregidor by PT boat eventually, and they could take very little with them. So many of his earlier papers and even his library, he had a huge library of books about war, that all disappeared. Mm-hmm. Much of it was burned up in the Philippines.
He really does seem to have been more talented as for self-publicity than as a general, though, in the end.
He loved self-publicity, and of course he wrote his own communiques so that they weren't necessarily factual, but they glorified him. He wore a chest full of ribbons, and almost all of which he was legitimately entitled to. The one he wasn't at the start was the Medal of Honor, the only medal that he hadn't earned in World War One. But his father had a Medal of Honor. His father had been a general in the Spanish-American War and earlier as a young officer in the Civil War. And for a while, he wore his father's Medal of Honor ribbon. General Marshall knew that he desperately wanted a Medal of Honor. And when the country needed a hero just as desperately, in the dark days of December 1941, Marshall wrote up the only fiction I think he ever composed. It was a Medal of Honor citation for MacArthur. And when MacArthur was evacuated by PT boat and bomber from the Philippines to Australia, in the first days he was there, he was awarded a Medal of Honor. This was given to him under the name of President Roosevelt, but it was written by Marshall.
Mm-hmm. Has any other general ever been responsible for so many disasters and yet...
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear that.
Let me repeat the question,
thank you
for your call. The caller's asking if any other general has been as responsible for as many disasters as MacArthur was.
Certainly not in World War II or in Korea. Mm-hmm. Perhaps the greatest disaster he was involved in was not in World War II, but the disaster in Korea, where he predicted to President Truman and to the chiefs of staff in Washington that if his troops went up to the north of Korea to the Yalu River, the Chinese would not intervene and the North Koreans would collapse. Well, the Chinese did intervene, and it was possibly the most serious American defeat in all of our wartime history.
So, Stanley, we're seeing again this, you know, this move toward MacArthur, who's the most colorful figure. And again, I want to move us back a little bit to the true hero, in a way, in your book, which is George Marshall. You noted that he doggedly worked to become chief of staff by 1939 after the 1918 armistice had denied him, you know, a generalship. And you said he had ramrod integrity. And I want to know, what did that do for President Roosevelt? What did it do for America?
Yeah. That ramrod integrity, I said part of that might have been due to his own deprivation earlier that created that kind of character, that kind of personality. That meant that it was very difficult to do a snow job on him. No one could tell him what to do that turned out to be self-publicity or turned out to be exploitative, and that meant Winston Churchill as well as President Roosevelt. He would talk back to both of them, and he would say when Churchill said, "Let's invade the soft underbelly of Europe rather than cross the Channel in invading France," Marshall said, "That soft underbelly." Has stainless steel baseboards, steel baseboards. In other words, the mountains were a great impediment. He didn't want to do it.
Mm-hmm.
He knew that Churchill wanted to save the British Empire in every possible way and create invasions that would delay the defeat of Germany in order to save British colonies. Marshall just stood upright about that, wouldn't let that happen.
Stanley,
and Churchill admired him and called him afterwards the organizer of victory.
And Stanley, we have another caller, and I want to turn to that caller in Champaign. So caller on line one, please go ahead.
Hi. I'm a retired professor from Kansas State University, and there was a story going around there that when Columbia University was looking for a president, the board met and thought, well, Milton Eisenhower was president of Kansas State for a while. They moved to Pennsylvania and then eventually ended up at Johns Hopkins, I think. And so they decided to offer the position to Milton Eisenhower, told the secretary, send a note to Eisenhower. And she sent it to Ike. And by that time, it was too late, and they had to hire Ike as president of Columbia. Is there any truth to that story?
I think Eisenhower was their first choice.
Which one? Milton
Nicholas Murray Butler had been president for many, many years and had just run Columbia down tremendously in all kinds of ways by neglect. He was old and feeble, and they couldn't figure out a way to get rid of him, but he died. And they thought that Eisenhower had the kind of reputation and personality that would enable them to regain prestige and also, in particular, to raise money.
Now, Stanley, our caller is asking, when you say Eisenhower, you mean Dwight Eisenhower was their first choice.
Yeah, was it Dwight or Milton you're talking about?
I'm sorry.
You're saying Dwight Eisenhower was their first choice at Columbia?
Yes.
Yes.
But
okay.
And not Milton.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. He was the first choice because the fat cats who were the trustees of Columbia had gotten to know him pretty well. They played bridge with him. They knew his personality. They were quite sure that even if they couldn't keep him very long, he would turn out to be a great fundraiser and rejuvenate the alumni support of the university.
Now, Stanley, I want to look a little bit at what I thought was one of the most interesting links between these three men, which is they were all at one time considered presidential timber. And I wondered if we could go through chronologically. MacArthur was first thought of as a potential president or vice presidential candidate in the 30s. Is that correct? And what were the circumstances?
Well, he thought that when Hoover ran for re-election in 1932, he might be named vice president.
Okay.
He was wrong. That didn't happen. He was out of the picture on the way to the Philippines at the next election in 1936, but he thought he'd have a shot at it in 1940. In 1940, he was still in the Philippines, hadn't been back to the U.S. Except for one short trip. In 1937, people didn't know him anymore. So he was really out of the picture in 1940. But he'd become quite a hero, exploiting his opportunities during World War II. and he was quite sure that he would be a leading candidate in 1944. It turned out, again, that since he was away, he refused to come back to the States to campaign. Tom Dewey, the young governor of New York, got the nomination in 1944, and he was out of it again. But at that point, there was talk of Marshall as a candidate as early as 1940,
mm-hmm.
To promote Marshall as a candidate in order to try to keep Roosevelt from having a third term. And Marshall refused. He said he had no interest in being a candidate for any political office at any time.
Mm-hmm.
And that left him out. But MacArthur persisted. And in about 1946, the year after World War II ended, he and Eisenhower met in Tokyo. By then, Eisenhower was chief of staff of the Army, replacing Marshall. And they talked about the presidency, and each one said, "Oh, you're going to be president next." And the other one would say, "Oh, no, you'll be president next." And it turned out that neither was, but by the next presidential election, Eisenhower was president of Columbia University, and his reputation was a sterling one. On the other hand, MacArthur, in 1948, had no chance of running against Truman, and Truman won re-election with Dewey running again because MacArthur refused to campaign, refused to come back. Many other generals had huge welcome parties when they came back after the war. He didn't have one. He was actually worried that if he came home, he would not be allowed to go back to Japan to be the occupation czar. And he wanted to stay there and, in effect, be Emperor of Japan by proxy.
Mm-hmm.
But the interesting thing occurred in 1952. In 1952, Eisenhower was covertly campaigning for president. There was no question about it. Papers have emerged that show how he was covertly campaigning, even doing things that were against Army regulations to propel his campaign. And Senator Robert Taft of Ohio was his chief opponent at that time, and it was likely one or the other would get the nomination. Taft proposed to MacArthur, who by then had been relieved from Korea by President Truman, and who was very bitter about it and wanted to get back and really wanted to be president. He said, "Why don't you become my vice presidential candidate? I'll make you, in effect, the Secretary of Defense. You'll be in charge of national security affairs, and you'll be my vice president, and that will give you a shot at the presidency." And MacArthur refused to be second banana to anybody. He refused to become a vice presidential candidate on a ticket with Taft. If he had done so, and that would have propelled Taft to the nomination and to election, and the election would have been very likely at that point because people were tired of five terms of Democrats. He would have been president because Taft only lived 6 months into the next presidency. He didn't know he had been dying of cancer.
Mm-hmm.
He died 6 months into what turned out to be the presidency of Dwight Eisenhower. And MacArthur might have been president.
Well, Stanley, we're now at the end of our hour, and I would like to thank you very much for taking the time to chat.
You're welcome. I hope I answered all the questions that we could.
It was wonderful.
Yeah.
I'm Bill Hammack, and I've been talking with Stanley Weintraub, author of 15 Stars, Eisenhower, MacArthur, Marshall, Three Generals Who Saved the American Century.